Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Today we're going to meet an old friend, a previous guest on Science Studio. His name is John Peterson, and he's a professor of anthropology but dabbles in paleoclimates. He does archaeology. He knows all about historical ecology. And there he is in Guam. Welcome back, John, to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith.
And obviously Russ Chianelli is here, and Russ has got a great association with John, so it's like an old family here. Just briefly, for the listener that doesn't remember your program of about 8 years, 9 years ago, background. Where do you come from? How did you get into your career? And then we'll go on to Guam.
Well, I was here at UTEP about 15 years ago. And then a friend encouraged me to go to a summer faculty workshop in the Philippines. And that changed my life. I went from black and white to color, so to speak. The archaeology I was doing here was Spanish colonial period, and of course that's the landscapes there are the same era as well as native indigenous culture. So there was a nice connection, and I got a Fulbright Award the next year, and then just kind of kept heading west. I was in Hawaii for a few years, and then an opening came up in Guam as a director of a Micronesian Area Research Center. So I was posted there, and one day I was asleep, and they volunteered me to be a vice president for research. So since then, I've been punished, but that's one reason I'm here, as actually in that role, to see Russ about some research, but also to look for opportunities for collaboration between UOG, University of Guam, and UTEP.
Well, that's great. Tell us, just a lot of people would be like me, a bit ignorant. What is the status, political status of Guam?
I was in the line in the airport in Phoenix a couple of days ago, and I handed them my Guam driver's license, and then the guy says, no, I need a U.S. identification. I said, it is. It's a territory.
It's a territory.
I had to argue with him. Finally, he said, oh, go on.
Tell us, what is a territory?
Well, depending on the particular historical relationship, four different jurisdictions became territories: Guam, American Samoa, Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico. And mainly it's that we have everyone in those territories has citizenship in the U.S., but some limited rights. We can't vote for president. Not that that, you know, is a big issue to most of us these days. Even though we are the first open polling place in the U.S., since we're the other side of the international
dateline. Oh, yeah, that's right.
And sometimes the national news gets on and does a straw poll in Guam at 7 a.m. U.S. time to tell people what the wind blows.
If they can't vote, why do they do it? What's the point of having all this activity?
We have economic relationship with the United States,
right?
And there's also, of course, freedom to travel and then move to the States. And if you go to California, you register to vote there.
Tell us a little bit about Guam. Has a big history in World War II.
It was one of the landing sites. Saipan and Guam and the Mariana Islands were kind of a couple of the last in the Western Pacific to fall to the U.S. And in the village where I live, Assen, there's a large beach area where one of the main landing parties from the U.S. Forces came ashore. I walk my dog there every morning now, and it's a beautiful National Park Service facility. But you've got to remember the 3,000 or 4,000 Americans that were killed on that beach coming on shore.
Tell us about the Japanese soldier that came out in 1972 that was hiding in the woods.
That's
a fascinating story.
There were several that did not turn themselves in right away, and one of them stayed hidden in the forest until 1972. He had married before he left Japan, and his wife had not remarried. She rejoined
him.
Yeah, she rejoined him. And he visited Guam many times later in his life, which was already pretty late by then, but he was kind of an honored citizen of Guam after that.
That's a fascinating story.
Do the Guamese, if that's the right word, pay U.S. income tax?
Yes, but to Guam. So we use a 1040 form, and all the proceeds go to Guam.
Okay.
And then the service people, there are two large military bases, Air Force and Navy, and the service people pay income tax to Guam while they're rotating through Guam. So that's the strength of the relationship with the U.S. compared to Saipan and Tinian to the north, which became a commonwealth, and they don't have those tax relationships.
Okay.
Anybody moving to make it a state like is happening in Puerto Rico?
Both directions. There's a movement in Guam sometimes to actually disaffiliate with the U.S., just like in Puerto Rico. So it goes both ways.
what have you learned about anthropology in Guam? Having moved from the Southwest, slight detour through Philippines and then also Hawaii, what's the big issue that you've discovered that you really said, my goodness, this is just a perfect place for someone like me to be?
The Pacific has been a real seedbed for anthropological theory, going back to Malinowski and, of course, Margaret Mead in Samoa and so forth. And those indigenous cultures are still really vital and vibrant and intact in many cases. And then the archaeology is kind of untouched. There's been some projects in Guam because of U.S. development laws and so forth. But throughout most of the region, there have been really very, very little archaeological work. And the substantial amount, or the amount that there has been, all indicates an early migration through the region by people sailing hundreds of miles using traditional navigation techniques. And yet there are people today doing that same sailing who will jump in an outrigger canoe in an outer island of Yap and sail several hundred miles to Guam without a GPS or a compass. It's incredible that those traditions are still alive. So that's the attraction.
And what do they go for? I mean, is that just for the adventure, or are they're looking to immigrate? Or I mean, that's a big trip to make. Yeah. Just, you don't go there to get the Sunday Times or something like that. Yeah, why are they doing this?
Of course, nowadays it's because people want to preserve traditions.
All right.
1,000 years ago, it was because people were connected in that region. Imagine an area the size of the continental U.S. with several thousand tiny islands in it, completely separated from each other by ocean, or as the islanders say, connected by ocean. And then think of people sailing around, and they read currents, they read ocean currents, they read the stars, they read the sun. And with that, they're able to pinpoint a location hundreds of miles away, and then to hear them say it, that they are not sailing to Guam, for example. Their Guam is coming to them.
You know, it reminds me now that when you were here, there was this big fight going on about how North America was populated by the Bering Strait and people coming across, and our friends that was working with us here were saying, no, that's not right. They were coming up from Chile and so on. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because I remember that was now accepted. But then, if you were on one side or the other, you might lose tenure or something.
Well, there's open questions. I don't know how strong the argument is about people coming up from Chile.
That was a dead issue.
I think so. They're chicken remains. But again, those can come from a lot of different connections.
Oh, chickens fly anyway.
Chickens fly, right.
Well, one of the things that's always interesting about these long trips, Thor Heyerdahl, try to reproduce one. But I know that Easter Island's not very close to Guam. But nevertheless, I mean, there was a whole story about the Easter Island, those monolithic great stones and statues. Do you know anything about those?
I don't know so much about Easter Island, but in Micronesia, there are stone architectural features that all started around 1000 AD. And in fact, we're working on a World Heritage nomination right now, linking those sites over this area, again, as big as the continental U.S. People about 1,000 years ago, by 2,000 years ago, they were already sailing all over the place. And they had little pockets, little villages that were isolated on different islands, and they were connected by matrilineal kin units and affiliations. So there were some places they could safely sail and other places not so much. Anyway, this went on for 1,000 years. By about 1,000 years ago, people in various places each started developing very distinctive stone architectural features. And in Ponape, that includes the site of Nan Madol, which is a ceremonial complex with gigantic prismatic basalt blocks, very elaborate constructions. And in Guam, it consisted of lattice stones, which are like a base, a pillar with a cap on it, where beams are set on top to make both residential and communal houses. And in Yap, it was the stone money and walkways, and the stone money was quarried in Palau, where there were stone forts. So you see, all of these happened about the same time. Well, it wasn't out of thin air.
Nowhere.
It was because there was a connection amongst these people, linked by this traditional navigation. And yet there was enough difference in each region that they expressed it differently.
As an anthropologist, does it dawn upon you to try to apply to one of the funding agencies to actually replicate some of those trips? You know, you say people are taking off for 100 miles and navigating. Wouldn't that be just wonderful? As long as you've got someone
well,
with
how do you
to,
think he got
to
here?
Do it. Yeah, well, I think American Airlines probably don't quite use the same technology.
That's been done. Ben Finney at the University of Hawaii found a traditional navigator in named Maupulog, I think is how you pronounce his name. And anyway, he was from the outer islands between Yap and Chuuk. And he's the one that helped them navigate the Hokulea, the famous Hawaiian canoe that sailed, that's now currently, I think, sailing around the world.
Oh.
So that was done starting, excuse me, back in the 80s, I think.
Well, before we leave that, where does all that stone come from? The Easter Island stone is indigenous to the island?
Yeah, it's all
oh,
that's
it is. So
indigenous.
It is already, yeah. Nobody had to drag it.
Impressive
from.
Moving them. We have the lattice sets are usually like about 4 or 5 feet tall, but there are giant ones that are like 12 to 15 feet tall in one of the islands, and impressive feats of engineering to quarry these and then erect them. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's amazing what old societies managed to do that we look on with quite amazement.
And I know that you had the pyramids and those statues in Easter Island, and some people were saying it was the aliens helped them.
Yeah, right. Van den Eyken, right? Yeah.
Oh, down in the Altiplano, down in Chile and that. Historical ecology. You're a well-known historical ecologist. Tell us, what does that mean and why are you interested in it and what are you learning right now in Guam?
It goes back to the cultural geographers of the 30s and 40s, Carl Sauer and Donald Brand in Texas, really looking at the relationship between people and the environment, that simply. And in a place like Texas, of course, that's reasonable, looking at the desert and movement of nomadic peoples and hunting and gathering peoples and finally Pueblo and peoples. But then in the oceanic regions, there's a different trajectory. And it depends on the ocean largely, but also tropical conditions. And in terms of the ocean, there has been a historical trend in sea level rise and fall that isn't mirrored most places in the world. Actually, about 6,000 years ago, sea level in the Pacific was about 1.8 meters higher than it is today. From the last period of glaciation, 20,000, 22,000 years ago, sea levels rose about 100-some meters, 130 meters. And then if you look at the global curves, it kind of came up toward modern levels. But if you look at the Pacific curves, it came up and then back down almost 2 meters. And this is well documented in the geomorphology along the coastline, which is one of the things that I do, is looking at those changes in the shoreline.
So repeat for our audience the time scale you're talking about, millions of years.
No, thousands.
Thousands of years.
22,000 years ago, we were in the middle of a full glacial period on Earth.
Yeah, okay.
Sea level was 130 meters lower than today. And you find archaeological projects all over on the gigantic coastal plain of Florida. People are finding Paleo-Indian sites many, many miles from shore that are now underwater.
Okay.
I worked on a cave. In fact, Russell, the project we did with Carmen to date the fossil coral polyp that was coated with laminated travertine, that was from a cave 40 meters below sea level today. And Carmen's dates using uranium thorium done here by Dr. Lee at UTEP showed that cave had formed as part of a coral reef. The coral reef formed about 120 some thousand years ago. Then water went down. A flank margin cave formed that was dated to about 91,000 years ago, which is a period we know globally was actually when it was above sea level. Then it was submerged again and then emergent again. And then finally, after the last, it was submerged for many years and then emergent again. It's on this oscillating.
Tell us why it is, though, that over in Oceania, you've got this discrepancy between the rising sea level and then the dropping sea level, which is not found around the rest of the world. You said that this particular location is the sea level is much lower now than it was years back, but that's not typical of the rest of the planet.
Yes, there's a couple of theories. One is something about equatorial siphoning. Another is hydroisostatic changes, where it's creating bubble effects, in other words. So, all right, 6,000 years ago, we entered a global climatic period called the altothermal. It was warmer, maybe a degree centigrade warmer for a couple of thousand years. It didn't impact ocean rise all over the world, but it did create higher sea levels in the equatorial specific because of this hydroisostatic effect, like the lens of a bubble.
Okay.
So
this is well understood now in terms of physics and all the rest of it.
I think so, yeah, yeah. And we have the geological evidence on the shorelines to prove it, yeah.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And today our guest is John Peterson. He's a professor of anthropology, University of Guam, and talking about interesting things. So this lens effect, has it been seen in lots of geological studies going back millions of years also, or is this just a very one-off example?
No, at least through the Pleistocene, Plioplastocene. You can see...
Remind people and me what Plioplastocene is.
Where it's a geological period that basically was 100-some-thousand plus years ago, and we're in the end of it, or arguably the beginning of the Holocene now. So these are times when glaciation affected large parts of the Earth because of the way continents shifted millions of years ago. And then how solar radiation hits the Earth and warms and cools different areas differently.
Let's talk a little bit, too, because I remember that there's also to do with the connections between the Atlantic and the Pacific. When they built the Panama Canal, they were worried that one was higher than the other, naturally.
There's that, but I think a bigger risk is the species that can flow from one basin to another. And we're looking now at problems in the Caribbean, for example, with the introduction of lionfish that came from the Pacific that are in normal population range in the Pacific but are eating up the reefs and out-competing all the other fish in the Caribbean. And they're so in the Caribbean, they're trying to encourage people to learn to cook them and eat them in new ways.
But the
and
point
why
is
it that they are so comfortable in the Caribbean?
They're no natural predators.
Ah, I suppose it's as simple as that.
Yeah.
That's when I left England and came to El Paso. I thrived. No natural predator. Now I understand the sequence of that's why immigration occurs, right?
But I think it's important to leave the point before going to the next one that there is a natural difference in sea level between the Pacific and the Atlantic all the time.
Yes, right. No,
and
there
the Pacific
is
higher.
It has to do with these. The Pacific is higher some of the time. We have these things called ENSO patterns where the water sloshes during El Nino, the water sloshes over toward California. During La Nina, it sloshes over toward Guam. And it makes it as much as a foot difference from period to period.
So, I mean, just going back, I've never thought of this, but I've done some barging in Europe and been through locks, double locks and triple locks. They're very, very clever. But so then in the case of the Panama Canal that Russ was talking about, then sometimes you've got to reverse the operation of the lock, right? Yeah. I mean, I never thought of that, so it's sort of interesting.
Yeah, and they're worried about this now where the Nicaraguans are talking about building a canal.
Let me go back to that concept of rising and lowering sea level, though, because it has huge cultural implications in the Pacific. When the sea level was 1.8 or 2 meters higher 6,000 or so years ago, it began coming down, and we think from looking at the shoreline geology, it came down in probably punctuated periods. Around 3,000 years ago, it may have dropped a meter, and 2,000 years ago, it dropped maybe a meter to modern levels. During the time that it was high, coral reefs formed within close to the surface, as coral reefs do. And as the sea level dropped, those reefs, those carbonate reefs, were emergent. And once they became emergent, and this is 2 meters lowering of sea level, then gradually birds brought seeds, you know, soils formed, coconuts grew, other plants and trees and so forth, and they became emergent as what we call atolls today. And a large percentage of the islands in Micronesia are these atolls. They formed as the reefs formed on top of, as barrier reefs around sinking volcanic masses, right? Anyway, like in Chuuk, the outer islands of Yap, various islands around Pohnpei, and the Marshall Islands entirely are atolls. And now, if we look at projected sea level today, you know, we're thinking maybe by 50 years from now, they may be underwater again, or by certainly 100 years from now. Well, what's kind of interesting
is that's because of
raising sea level again.
Yeah, but I mean, that's due to this bubble effect or a sinking of the volcanic underpinnings or global warming even?
Well, the sea level rise today coming up would be from global warming. And it's been about 3 millimeters, but in the Pacific, it's going up to 8 millimeters a year. And that's pretty well documented by
And there's one country that's almost disappearing, right?
Yeah, well, the Marshall Islands, but Kiribati actually has leased an island off Fiji for people to move to, and they're starting to migrate there. From the Marshall Islands, they're migrating to Arkansas.
Listen, we could talk about
that. That's a tremendous long navigation by the stars all the way from Marshall Island to Arkansas.
Their foreign minister, Tony DeBroom, is...
I mean, go ahead.
Their foreign minister, Tony DeBroom, likes to say that he used to say 1 in 8, now he says 1 in 4 Tyson's frozen chickens are touched by Marshallese. Because they migrate there to work in the chicken industry.
How interesting.
Listen, we could talk about this for a long time, but I also want to ask you about your educational type grants like EPSCoR and so on, what you're doing around the world with that.
That's one reason I'm here, Russ. Well, first of all, we have a joint research project on a cave in Guam with pigments that are said to be part of a panel showing star navigation charts. So Russ and his students are going to help us characterize the geology, the geochemistry
of those bird pigments. Droppings are ruining them too, huh?
But the wasp nests.
Oh, the wasps. Okay.
Yeah, mud dauber nests. So we want to see how we can preserve them because we need to remove the nests and we need to know the chemical relations. So this is a project Russ and I have had going on for a couple of years. But then my travel to this area right now came about because University of Guam just recently was awarded a National Science Foundation EPSCoR grant, which stands for Experimentally Stimulated Program for...
Basically, it's money that go to states and now I know
thank you.
Commonwealths, which don't usually get high NSF funding. So Wyoming would be eligible because they don't have the big resources. Massachusetts, I think, never gets an EPSCoR.
Texas shouldn't either.
But New Mexico probably...
New Mexico's in it.
Yes.
30-some states are in it. And it was started back in the 70s. Now, many other U.S. federal agencies have EPSCoR programs. NASA has one, and so does National Institutes of Health. So there was a meeting in Tucson of the NASA EPSCoR group, and now that we're in the NSF group, we were invited to be in that. So I went to Tucson for that meeting, and one of the things we look for in the EPSCoR fellowship, if you will, is developing collaborative projects and working toward building innovation in all of the universities that are part of the network. And in a big NSF workshop we went to last year, in fact, they had this phrase I just love. It's innovation is a contact sport. And it's fantastic. It means, they give us a lot of money for travel because they want people to get out and meet each other and share ideas but also share...
Yeah. I mean, it's just like the old concept of networking, except that, this networking has got a focus to a certain degree.
Yes.
Lovely.
And you were just up in Alaska, too. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
Part of the same travel. In Alaska, there was an Arctic Energy Summit. We work with people there on renewable energy. The interesting connection is that Alaska is very similar, believe it or not, to the Western Pacific because of the isolated outposts of settlement. It's just as hard to get to Barrow as it is to Chuuk even though it's land instead of water.
Tell me about Guam now. You said renewable energy. I remember once I spent about a month in New Zealand, and the newspapers were tracking the arrival of a tanker full of petroleum products. In those days, it was from Iran. How does Guam deal with energy? Is it wind power? Is it imported oil? Do you have any natural resources there?
Well, it's something we're working hard to provide leadership for. We have a Center for Island Sustainability, and that's the framework, the home for EPSCoR at our university. We've been promoting solar energy and some to some extent wind energy and other alternatives like waste to energy. Years ago, the Guam Power Authority bought into oil-generated electricity. And, except for the swings in prices, it's been relatively okay. Right now, it's pretty cheap. Our rates are only 21 cents a kilowatt hour, which is cheaper than here.
Where does the oil come from?
Singapore. And it's a small carrier.
Right.
It comes specifically to Guam and goes back again. So there are no great efficiencies. In fact, it's pretty inefficient. But we're trying to encourage 20% renewable energy generation by 2020, and down the road by 2030, 2050, we want to follow the lead of Hawaii and other places that are going to go to 50% and then even greater by 2050. I mean, it doesn't make sense to import any kind of material to Guam when we can produce
it efficiently. Is there any explorers there with these 3,500-foot deep, huge wells that may be around?
Well, the problem with Guam is it drops off really deep right offshore, down to 7,000 feet or so. It's kind of tough to launch a platform there. But there's possibilities of geothermal energy on some of the more northern islands. We have a very little opportunities on Guam. There's one place by the Hilton Hotel where a steam vent comes out. Mm-hmm. We're hopeful about that.
I don't know if you know, but since you left, several places here in El Paso have gone to thermal energy.
Oh, no.
There's a high school up in Canutillo, which is completely geothermal energy. There's a fire station over in the east part of town. There's even a public housing development wow. in town. And so people are thinking about that, and somewhere the money is coming That's up great. And it's happening.
We have ocean opportunities. Like we have a current between Guam and Rota, 7 knots. I think we ought to be able to capture that.
You've been listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli here. And we were talking today to John Vitason, a professor of anthropology, University of Guam. Lots of little snippets. We didn't get into any one area. You just got a very multifaceted sort of
means
activity.
You got to come back.
Yeah, you got to come back multiple times.
We'd like to thank Norma Martinez, our producer.
So I hope you enjoyed this program, and we hope you'll be back next week for another Science Studio. Take care.